It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Haw.
And I'm Kirk Colbert. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Kirk, this is a story about a heat stroke death by a young boy. This is a Georgia father who has actually been charged with felony murder in the death of his 22-month-old son after the boy was left inside a mini SUV for hours on a sweltering day. And people might ask, what is felony murder? Well, if you commit certain crimes, certain felonies, that would be, and in the process of doing so, as a direct result of that, cause the death of another human being,
right,
then you can be charged with felony murder. 46 states, I believe, have felony murder laws. We do have a felony murder law in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's one of those specified for certain crimes.
Right, and it's odd because the concept is that it's supposed to be a further deterrent from committing basic felonies, even without the intent to commit murder.
Right.
So the idea would be, let's say you don't have the intent to kill, you're not engaging in activity that would by itself be reckless. Like, let's say you're driving a car 100 miles an hour down the road with your eyes closed, well, and you kill somebody. Well, that would be naturally a form of homicide. That would be a reckless homicide.
Sure.
But the idea behind felony murder is that you're doing something else that just is a felony, and if someone dies as a result of it, and there's all kinds of different ways that this could end up happening.
And that's what this father, this Georgia father, has been charged with. His family claims it was an honest and tragic mistake. And the police disagree, and they're saying that Justin Ross Harris, 33 years old, he now faces heightened charges in a heat stroke death, which has drawn outrage from people who believe the man has already suffered enough. This from ABC News. Harris buckled his son Cooper into his car seat on Wednesday before heading to his job as a web developer at a Home Depot corporate office near Atlanta. And on the way, Harris was supposed to drop off his son at daycare. He never did. The temperature outside reached 92 degrees by noon. Hours passed, and as Harris was driving home for the night, he noticed his son still in the back seat and pulled into a shopping center parking lot. Witnesses say he rushed to try to save Cooper. He kept saying, "What have I done? What have I done?" according to one witness. He laid his son on the ground and started doing CPR, trying to resuscitate him. Apparently, the child wasn't responding. And after searching Harris's office, police arrested the grieving father and charged him with felony murder and child endangerment. Now, this has caused a lot of outrage for a variety of reasons.
This does happen. I'm not going to say all the time, but it's not uncommon. And it's unfortunate that, we see people mistreating their animals by leaving them in a hot car, and we all know that's bad. And you would think that if you have an infant or a toddler or somebody that is unable to care for themselves, unable to open the door and get out, that you'd be paying more careful attention. However, the way that this normally happens, and I saw a report on this recently, is that it's usually when there's a change in routine. Like, let's say the mother is normally the one that drops off the child at daycare, and there's a change because she has to go do something or she's away out of town on a business trip, and then it's the father's responsibility, or vice versa. It doesn't really matter. And then just because of the routine, he forgets and then realizes at some point later that, oh my gosh, I forgot to drop the child off. The thing that's a little different about this case, they're hinting that the prosecutors are hinting that there's more to the story. If you think about it, it would be a way that someone could, if they wanted to kill their 22-month-old child, could basically stage this as an accident and say, oh my gosh, I look what happened. What have I done? And it could have been a deliberate way,
Exactly. Yeah. They got a search warrant, and a search warrant has to be based on probable cause of some type of criminal activity, right?
So, they wouldn't bother to do it if it was a simple mistake.
Right. And so there could be more to this story is the point. Now, I tend to think that the sentiment and sympathize with the sentiment that if, in fact, this was merely a mistake, charging him with felony murder when you've already got a child endangerment charge.
Right. So, 'cause the felony would be the child endangerment, right, which seems like this is a concept that sometimes we refer to as duplicitousness.
Yeah.
Duplicity.
Right.
Where someone's charged with committing one act and being committing the crime two different ways. So a predicate for child endanger, for felony murder would be that he's committing a felony, the felony being the same thing that he's charged with as the murder.
Absolutely.
So,
and in Wisconsin, although this is a Georgia case, but in Wisconsin, again, whoever causes the death of another human being while committing or attempting to commit a crime specified, and then they specify certain crimes. Now, these are more serious crimes, but to prove that, the state only has to prove that the defendant's conduct was a substantial factor.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be the only factor. It just has to be a substantial factor. And so that's a pretty low threshold when we're talking about a felony murder type situation. And it seems to me that the, you know, I'd have to look at the statistics on this, but the argument that this is somehow going to deter other people when in fact there's some type of accident that occurs while in the commission of a felony that presumably has some sort of intent requirement seems a bit far-fetched. But
yeah, and you know, I can see some individuals taking the position that, you know, although he's suffered enough, and even if it is determined that this is an accident, that he still needs to be prosecuted to serve as a deterrent for others to take this matter more seriously. But I can tell you this, it would be inconceivable that a parent who truly loves his or her child, as nearly all parents do, I mean, a lot of, at least, let's say the majority, would be deterred in any way by prosecuting this guy. I mean, I'm sure that if he had a, if he cared for his child like most parents do, it's not going to put anybody on guard so as not to leave their child in a hot car. I mean, you know you're not supposed to do that. And if it happens, it's nearly always, or it would appear that it's always an accident. But another thought occurred to me. What else could they be looking for in his office? And I thought about this because when this got reported on the news, it just seemed so odd to me. And then I thought, maybe they're looking to see what he did throughout the day. And if he checked the temperature, if he was distracted by doing something else, or to match up that day's activities with his normal daily routine to see if it varied in some way. Like if somebody goes out to lunch every day and gets in their car, but for some reason that day he didn't, that might provide insight into whether or not he knew that his child was still in the vehicle and he was letting him, you know, more or less roast out there. On the other hand, how did they get the search warrant?
How did they get the search warrant? How did they get the evidence?
How did they get probable cause?
How did they get probable cause to go in and try to find that evidence? Yeah, and it strikes me as there may be something more going on here, and we may be doing another segment on this.
Well, I'm sure we will. It's an unfolding story.
Right, where it turns out that he's being investigated for something even more serious than felony murder, which is an intentional or some other type of situation there. But I just, you know, you see these stories happen and you hear about these, and you're right, Kirk, you hear about the situations with people leaving their dogs, leaving their pets in the car in very high temperatures.
And that's usually done intentionally, but where the person figures the dog can handle it, or they just don't care, they don't treat the dog like a sentient being.
Well, Kirk, there's a new important case that came out on cell phone searches. Police need a warrant to search people's cell phones.
Kelly Meyer was even talking about this the other day. I heard him on the radio.
The Supreme Court on Wednesday unanimously ruled that police may not search the cell phones of criminal suspects upon arrest without a warrant. This, according to CNN.com, a sweeping endorsement for privacy rights by a 9-0 vote. The justices said that smartphones and other electronic devices were not in the same category as wallets, briefcases, and vehicles, all currently subject to limited initial examination by law enforcement. Generally, such searches can be permitted if there's probable cause that a crime's been committed. But there were a couple of cases that came down involving potential drug and gang activity where police looked through phones.
They've been looking. You know, if they arrest somebody, they just immediately look at their phone.
And we've seen it sometimes where they try to get a warrant, but you know, there are certainly lots of situations where in the past they're going to now have to change their procedures in many parts of the country to. And I think this is absolutely the right decision for various different reasons, not the least of which is you can find out so much information about a person by looking at their cell phone, everything from where they've been to who they're friends with to what types of messages they've written, all of their emails, what types of communications. I mean, literally, we're carrying around with us, if you have a smartphone, every day, everything about our lives.
Yeah, it's not even a snapshot of your life.
It is
really your life. It's really a a complete documentation of your life, because we do use our cell phones for everything now. Not just who we talk to, but it's how we communicate. It's how we shop.
Right.
It's how we pay our bills. Everyone we know and everything we say to people are represented in the data in our cell phones. And I think there's been speculation as to why this was a 9-0 decision, which is extraordinarily unusual on an issue that has to do with law enforcement versus civil rights. We got to take a break, but we're just getting into this, and I can tell we're going to tackle this very aggressively when we come back from this break. We'll be right back.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Hello, hello, baby, you called, I can't hear a thing. I have got no service in the club, you say. What did you say? Oh, you're breaking up on me. Sorry, I cannot hear you, I'm kind of busy.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Just before the break, we were talking about the new Supreme Court decision, United States Supreme Court decision that was issued this past Wednesday, involving the police and whether or not they need a warrant to search a cell phone that has been found on a person who has been arrested for an offense. Now, before the break, we were talking about the fact that this is one of those unusual 9-0 types of decisions. Since Wednesday, there's been a bit of commentary out there. Everybody's got something to say about this opinion. Number one, because it was surprising that the Supreme Court took this stance. Number two, that surprising that it was unanimous. The Supreme Court more and more has been lacking unanimity in their decisions, especially given the current makeup of the Supreme Court. We see the same thing with our state Supreme Court, by the way.
Right.
More often than not, we see a non-unanimous decision, and there are dissents or concurrences and various opinions on things that we see in the court system. Now, the thing that's unusual about this case is that everybody predicted that because of some other Supreme Court cases that had come down in the past couple of years, there's been this indication that cell phones by their nature in and of themselves, and whether or not your expectation of privacy is the same as that which you have in your home, because that's where the founders sort of put the focus. That's where the anchor of the Fourth Amendment is in the home. Now, you have a right to privacy and an expectation of privacy to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures in other places, in your person, in your car, in the things that you do and the people you talk to and that sort of thing. But it's different. It's different than in the home, because the home is,
right,
is your castle. You know, king of the castle is,
exactly,
is what you're supposed to be.
Yeah, and Kirk, this seems to be a situation that I think many courts are starting to recognize more and more as we have these advancements in technology, as we have all of these new ways of communicating, and as more and more judges and justices themselves use this technology, I think it really does come back to that, because you start thinking about, and I'm not suggesting they didn't rule on the law. I think that it was a correct ruling. I'm just saying you can identify more with, yeah, these types of things.
Well, that's what I was going to say. But that's what I was going to say, by the way, is that, okay, they did a little research and figured, yeah, out even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, the old looking lady, she's got a cell phone. So they all got cell phones is the point. So, you know, we're in that era where all the justices apparently have cell phones that they use, and that apparently they realize themselves, you know, that there's another controversy brewing right now in the Wisconsin Supreme Court about whether or not they should be able to have their, you know, meetings, their deliberation meetings, where they kind of flesh out the issues in different petitions that have been filed with the court via email. And they've not done that traditionally for a number of reasons. But I know that Justice Gableman recently said it would be a lot easier if we could just do this stuff by email. The implications are, of course, that this is part of the government, and anything that they email back and forth to each other would theoretically be,
open
subject to open records,
yeah,
disclosures. And because of the function of the court, they would like to keep that secret because people can change their minds and that sort of thing. But getting back to this Riley case that came out, the balance there, interestingly enough, is that as we saw several signals from cases, as I said, over the past few years, where the Supreme Court has been signaling that the the overall standard for what a citizen expects to have be public and not, or what is private and what isn't, and what's out there in the world and what remains part of your private personal home life. Well, we saw decisions that indicated that everybody knows that cell phones can be tracked through GPS or cell phone triangulation or these other things. And because of the fact that data is much more accessible either through hackers or through if you work for an employer and you're put on notice that it's not right. necessarily private. There are so many things in our or when you're walking down the street, we say this all the time on the show, you're walking down the street, you're probably, if you're in an urban area or even a semi-urban area like Sheboygan, you're being photographed unknowingly
all the time,
hundreds of times a day if you're walking down, you know, a main street, because there's surveillance cameras all over the place. And people know that. So our expectation that we're not going to be subject to surveillance, so to speak, has been changed because society has changed. And that's really where a lot of people predicted that the Supreme Court would come down in this case. But what it really comes down to, and we're not just talking about the police saying randomly they want to grab someone's cell phone and look at it. That's not the issue in this case. It's whether or not when someone is arrested and there's a cell for a crime. I mean, there's already probable cause to believe the person committed a crime. Yeah. Now they want to look at the phone. And the idea that you can merely look at someone's phone because it may be evidence of a crime or it may be evidence that's important in the case, it doesn't hold water anymore. And we've seen that argument kind of lose its power over the past, I'd say, 2 years. Several Supreme Court cases that have whittled away at that concept.
And it probably helps that now 90% of Americans have a cell phone, and I think 56% of those Americans have a smartphone of some sort.
Yeah.
And so you can carry it around. It would almost be like, analogize it to going into somebody's house, and they have a diary of everything that they've done. And the police, and that diary now is part of the cell phone. It's on the cell phone. It's every communication you've had. It's every email that you've sent. It's every text messages that you've sent to your significant
other. It's everything you've done.
It's all the pictures you've
every
yeah, it's
day.
Everything in your life. It's a snapshot. And so the police then having the ability to open that up merely because you've been arrested for an offense, I think absolutely makes sense that you need to have a warrant before you're going to do that. And although the founders could have never envisioned something like this it seems pretty clear based upon the text of the Fourth Amendment and based upon things that historically have been considered to be private. That cell phones would, at the very least, fit into that category.
Now, the reality of this is that, yes, it's going to impose that additional requirement of getting a warrant. I will tell you, though, it's not going to be hard to do because right. warrants are easier and easier to get. You know, a lot of judges don't like to be waking up in the middle of the night. But presumably, if a person is under arrest and if it's a crime for which they're going to be taken in custody, and the phone then is seized more or less as part of the person's personal property, they have however much time they need, you know, it could be days or more, to secure that warrant to take a look at the phone.
But you'd have to have some evidence to link up.
Well, you'd have to have
probable cause as to why you need to search the phone.
Right, which is why we have the need for the warrant right. to begin with. But if they, so in other words, we're getting rid of the freebies here, you know, just in other words, the stuff that you don't have to work for.
Yeah.
You don't have to prove to the judge or the magistrate that you think there's a crime there. You just sneak a peek at it, you know,
yeah.
which was going on a lot, you know, all the time, as a matter of fact. It was just like, hey, let's see what we can find out just for bonus points here. And, you know, usually there is something there.
Well, and what happened in one of these cases, Kirk, is that somebody was pulled over, I believe, for something, you know, fairly innocuous and fairly insignificant. And then once the officers were able to look at the phone,
yeah,
they
like,
found much more evidence to charge
them. While I've got you detained, let's just have a little peek at your phone here.
Right.
See what we find. Oh,
right.
my goodness.
And it
You're
almost,
a drug dealer.
And think about all the other people you talk to on your phone, right? I mean, it would
yeah.
be the police would then have access to every conversation that somebody's had
right.
about you.
Yes.
About your character. About
Or what
you
about
know,
your speed dial things?
Your
you know,
speed
it's,
dial,
it's
right.
It's got the pizza places you like, the prostitutes you may call. You know, the or
well,
not you,
not, that.
Not you,
not
but
me,
you know,
you.
Somebody out
somebody
there
else
might have that.
Somebody else might have that. You know, and every person you're friends with, right
yeah.
on Facebook, if you've got that, all kinds of pictures that you've taken, and so
your political affiliation,
your your political affiliation, perhaps.
Yeah, sure.
Where you've eaten, last week and this week. I mean, it's just
whether
crazy.
You've paid your taxes. That whether, might be
right. Exactly. There's all kinds of
everything.
Stuff. There's all kinds of stuff on there. So it leads you to now also ask the question, which is another evolving area, as to tracking with cell phones, right? Because we've seen cases that have recently or fairly recently been argued before the Wisconsin Supreme Court about real-time cell phone tracking. And that is, in essence, your police are able to, through various different devices, track somebody and their real-time movement.
Right, without a warrant.
Without a warrant. Within a very limited scope. I mean, we're talking about they can usually narrow it down to within several feet.
But let's distinguish this because you all, those of you that are regular listeners, will recall the case of Jones versus U.S. that came out, what, 3 years ago, two and a half years ago? And that said that the police can't attach a surveillance device to the bottom of your car surreptitiously and then watch where you go on a computer.
Right.
What we're talking about now, and there is technology that just by virtue of the fact that your phone is emitting a signal and receiving a signal, without the police having to do anything other than knowing what your phone is, your identifying information for your phone, which can be obtained without a warrant from cell phone companies, but through use of administrative subpoenas or from other information. All they got to do is know somebody who knows your phone number.
Yeah.
And then there is technology now that can track where you are just based on that information without getting a warrant.
And it's called a Stingray device.
Yeah.
And that's a really see now I'm getting all
they should give it
spooked
they should give it
thing.
a softer name like a snuggle device or
a snuggle
something.
Device right
instead of a stingray
or you know pick another animal like a you know a
hippopotamus
a squirrel or a llama yeah. or something like
a
that.
Llama device
how about a llama
well
device?
Judge we followed him on the llama device all over town and it turns out that he's made several stops to several known drug neighborhoods using the llama
there you go all right. Well, we do have to take another break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And Casey's joined by Kirk O'Bear.
All right. There you go, Kirk. You got that one right. Well, Kirk, there's a very nasty situation going on with a rape that occurred in 1975, a sexual abuse case that became Hillary Clinton's first criminal defense case as a 27-year-old lawyer. She's only spoken to the media since her attack, I believe, once, and this is referring to the victim in that case. She was raped as a 12-year-old, and the woman says that Hillary smeared her and used dishonest tactics to successfully get her attacker a lighter sentence, even though she claims Clinton knew that he was guilty. Okay.
Wow.
And there are some reports. There's newly discovered audio recordings from the 1980s, and this happened again 1975, but the 1980s that were unearthed by a newspaper and made public this past week. And in a long emotional interview with the Daily Beast, the victim in that case accused Clinton of intentionally lying about her in court documents, going to extraordinary lengths to discredit the evidence of the rape, and later callously acknowledging and laughing about her attacker's guilt on the recordings. And what happened in this was there was this interview. Hillary Clinton, then defense lawyer Hillary Clinton, attorney Hillary Clinton, had her client submit to a polygraph examination. The client passed the polygraph examination, and Hillary Clinton said something to the effect of, well, this destroyed my faith in polygraphs, and she can be heard sort of laughing at that, right?
Right, which doesn't mean that's...
It doesn't necessarily... Yeah. And here's the thing about it, this is a completely non-political statement, regardless of any sort of political affiliations. I would say this about any attorney who's defending a case. If you listen to that statement... it may appear to sound callous. It may appear to sound disrespectful. It may appear to sound wrong. But she may well have been laughing about the process of this, not the fact that somebody had been raped, Or allegedly raped, and actually,
I heard about this, but I don't know the whole backstory. How is it that this recording was ever made to begin with in the 1980s? And how is it found?
Well, it was released in the Clinton Library down in Arkansas, the University of Arkansas, and they've been, for whatever reason, releasing documents or releasing audio recordings intermittently.
Right.
This happened to be one that the newspaper went in and requested because it had been released, and this had been talked about just briefly in the 2008 campaign, and at the time, Hillary's campaign staff basically said, look, she was defending somebody who was accused of a crime. She's ethically required to vigorously defend that person, and they didn't really address the laughing part of it. But they did say, you know, she was putting on a vigorous defense. Now, when you look at the affidavits that were the affidavit that was signed by Hillary Clinton in this case, she talks about, you know, basically how this accuser, this victim, had basically a tendency and had accused another person falsely in the past, and she sort of alluded to
things that are always relevant to a criminal investigation,
right? Mental health
things that
issues.
Are relevant to both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer,
right,
and the police.
Right.
So certainly it's the kind of thing that anybody would look at. And if you're pointing out these problems, how many times have you heard? I've heard it many times. The prosecutor pointing out, Judge, we have a problem with our primary witness's credibility.
Sure.
It's not her fault, but it's true that in the past she's made false accusations. She has a reputation for not telling the truth. It doesn't mean she's lying now, and it doesn't mean that they think she's lying now. But what it means is these are things to consider in terms of how a jury is going to play out.
Right.
Now, if I understand correctly, this defendant was, in fact, convicted. Am I correct about that?
Yes, of a lesser charge.
Of a lesser charge.
Right.
And, you know, it goes back to the thing that we seem to talk about all the time, and anybody who does defense work is constantly in a position of trying to educate the public on why the job we do is so important. And it's important for justice. It's important for the system. And judges and prosecutors rely on us to protect defendants, because anybody can be accused of any crime. It doesn't matter who it is or how serious the allegation is. It can happen to anyone. And it happens to innocent people. It happens to people that are guilty, but going through the process of making sure that the evidence was gathered properly and the person's rights were protected is something that the other two parts of the process, that being the judge and the prosecutor, cannot do.
And they said also in this case, Kirk, that, and this is one that sort of got under my skin, they said that there was a loophole that was used in this case.
They always use that word when they're talking about defense lawyers, loophole.
Right, right. And in this case, what actually happened, according to the stories that I've read, is that there was some evidence, particularly some clothing or undergarments, that had some blood on it. The part of the undergarment was lost during the course of litigation by the prosecution.
That's not a loophole.
It's not a loophole. It was a destruction of evidence issue, and the destruction of evidence issue led to a favorable resolution in this case. So, you know, you can look at it as a loophole, I suppose. On the other hand, I think what's more appropriate is to look at it as, look, they lost the evidence. This person was on trial, facing very serious charges, has the right to contest the charges, has the right to challenge the evidence. And if he himself is not able to obtain that evidence and perhaps have it tested forensically, then he's at a disadvantage. And so it led to the outcome that perhaps, I don't know about the case, but perhaps was appropriate in the situation. The guy still did a year, I believe, in prison.
Yeah.
And you can say, well, that's not enough for 12-year-old situation.
This is all just based on criticism based on her role as a defense lawyer. And
right.
If there are people out there that think if you've defended somebody accused of a crime during the course of your career leading up to being a candidate for president, I have some bad news for those people. Because Abraham Lincoln was a defense lawyer. Our second president of the United States, John Adams, was a defense lawyer.
Yeah.
Not only that, but he defended the British
in
the Boston Massacre trial.
And Abraham Lincoln said that one of his proudest services to his country was being a defense lawyer, because he was a constitutional officer of the court. He defended people's Sixth Amendment rights.
Exactly. Does it make you think that maybe people were smarter in the 1850s, you know?
Well, I think we live in such partisan times, right? That anytime somebody is going out and doing this, there's automatic. There seems like there's a divide over everything. And what something that we all should be able to agree on, because as we know from the recent developments where, although, you know, this John Doe proceeding that has happened, people have moved to their political sides on this. Listen, Hillary Clinton has just as much of a right to be defended if she were accused of some wrongdoing, as does Governor Scott Walker.
Right.
And there should be no question about that. I mean, that's just, that is common sense. That's at the core of our Constitution. It's at the core of what our founders wanted. It's at the core of the Sixth Amendment. It's right in the Constitution that you have a right to be defended. And while defense lawyers have to vigorously defend their clients, you know, obviously it has to be done on ethical and legal grounds. They have to go through those. As long as there are ethical and legal grounds to do so, you have an obligation to defend vigorously your client.
Right.
Prosecutors.
It's un-American. To not do so.
I agree. And prosecutors have a duty to do justice. That's not just seeking out convictions.
Right.
That's doing justice. And when justice demands that a case be dismissed or that a case be amended, that's done. And I think
it's ethically required.
It's required. Absolutely. It's required. And so when we're attacking, you know, there was a story recently where a lot of defense lawyers, they were attacked for defending people who were, you know, facing charges at Guantanamo Bay, who had been held in captivity there. And it's very easy to defend somebody who's accused of some, you know, popular or unpopular offense, not even a crime, such as jaywalking, right? Yeah. Everybody could see that, or a speeding ticket, right? But when it comes to things like terrorism, or when it comes to things like murder, it's very easy to criticize some lawyer and say, you took on that case, because that's what they've said in this case. You took on that case. You weren't actually appointed. You agreed to take on that case. You agreed.
You know how I gave you the F. Lee Bailey book to read earlier today? It's a great book. I've read it. Yeah. But there's another book that I'm going to get you that's about the JAGs in the Army Air Corps that were assigned as defense counsel for the Nazi war crimes tribunals.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating story because a lot of the same sort of ethical and patriotic conflict comes into play, but the basic understanding that we have to make sure that and what strength of character it takes to actually apply the law to someone who's attacked your country, or someone who's accused of attacking your country, or somebody that's affiliated themselves, you know, as a Nazi or as Al Qaeda or as you know, part of a terrorist organization that you know.
Right.
And you know what? We went through an era. I was on the list of people that was supposedly, you know, qualified to represent people in Guantanamo, and I didn't have an aversion to it. I just didn't at the time when I was with another law firm, it didn't work out for me to be able to have the free time, I guess, if you want to put it that way, to go down and live in Cuba for 6 months at a time. It just wasn't possible for me, economically speaking. I had no moral opposition to it. But the people that I know in the JAG department, or former JAGs, that were able to do this, accept these assignments, basically were put in a situation where it made the government tried to make their jobs nearly impossible because of all the restrictions. And are a lot of people that got in trouble because they unwittingly violated some sort of technical rule that related to how you have contact with these people and so forth. And then there's all kinds of things that came into play. In other words, it's so extraordinarily difficult that it just takes an amazing level of devotion to your country, of, you know, the United States of America, to be able to stand up for your Constitution and the fact that we have rules and we have to follow them, no matter who it is that's on trial. It is paramount that those rules be applied evenly, uniformly.
Because some of the other countries that you know, are opposed to the United States and you know, maybe don't like the United States, some of these very countries are ones that don't have that type of a just system. That's, you know, one of the things that makes the United States unique.
Right.
All right. We've got to take a break, and we'll be back with a final segment in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. Another sort of gruesome story involving the death of a police officer. There are new documents that are shedding light on what happened during the drug raid where a Texas police officer was shot and killed on May 9th. The SWAT team served a search warrant for an individual. During the early morning raid, four officers were shot. Clearly a tragic situation, and a detective died later from his injuries. Two officers were protected by their gear, and another was hit in the leg. In a newly released affidavit, a police officer states that he spoke to the target of this search warrant after being arrested at the scene. It goes on to state that after being apprised of his constitutional rights and waiving those rights, the suspect informed me that he shot at a number of persons outside of his residence before he was taken into custody. Now, what happened in this situation is that this was a no-knock warrant where the police did not knock on the door. They allegedly announced their presence as police officers. However, I believe at least one of the officers was in plain clothes, if not all of the officers. And so what happened was, according to the story, they came in after this no-knock warrant, and they were shot by this man because he thought that apparently somebody was intruding into his home. Now, it's going to come down to, did he know that they were police officers, or did he reasonably believe that there was some type of intruder coming into his house?
Well, let's have a sidebar, Your Honor.
All right.
Let's talk about what a no-knock warrant is, because people might not know. The standard way of executing a warrant, and this is based on constitutional principles that have to do with the method of execution, because there are cases, and Wisconsin law doesn't necessarily give the federal interpretation, because there are various different circuits throughout the country. In the Seventh Circuit, they don't enforce the execution requirement that it be done in the least violent method possible. It's not as prominent of a theme in Seventh Circuit law. And since Wisconsin's in the Seventh Circuit, oftentimes our courts look to the federal circuits for guidance on those types of things. So putting all that legal gibberish aside, what it means is that normally you'll knock and you'll, say, "Police, please come to the door," and you'll wait 15 seconds before you knock the door down. You might even say it twice. You might say, "Hello, please come to the door. It's not a land shark." And then see if they come, just to give somebody the opportunity. And the reason behind that is that even though you're executing a warrant, a person still has the right to some dignity. They don't necessarily have to be in the midst of doing whatever they're doing without being prepared to come to the door, dressed,
sure,
not naked, whatever.
Right.
But in cases where the police believe that there is either danger afoot, or if there is a chance that evidence will be destructed as a result of announcing your entry, then they can apply for a no-knock warrant. And it's not hard to get one. All you got to do is say that there's a dog there. There's a dog there. We know there's a dog. We looked in the window. There's a dog. You're going to get a no-knock warrant. So here's the great irony of the situation is that if you know that you're dealing with a dangerous person, combine that with all of the states, ourself being one, where you have the king of the castle doctrine, and you can defend your property against any intruders, and they're wearing plain clothes, and they didn't get a knock warrant, they got a no-knock warrant, what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah.
They're going to get shot.
Well, it's a very dangerous situation. Right?
I mean, absolutely.
Certainly, it's a very dangerous situation.
I mean, we know that they're bad guys, okay? Because they're going to break down the door. If they had reason to believe that they were armed, that's one of the reasons they would have asked for a no-knock warrant in
right.
addition to the dog.
So it's a little bit, it's a strange situation. And by the way, according to the story, they thought that there was going to be drugs, there were going to be drugs found
right.
inside. There weren't. There were no drugs found inside.
That's the punchline of the footnote, I guess, is that, that what they were looking for originally, the reason that they got the warrant to begin with,
didn't exist.
They were wrong.
And so
and
now
they got shot.
Now the shooter is facing capital murder charges, or at least one, and then three counts of attempted capital murder. So he's now facing the death penalty.
Right.
In a situation where he apparently shot at these officers, and one of whom died. So this story is going to take on, I think, a life of its own, especially when we come to, is this a situation where I mean, this is a tragedy all around. We have an officer who died, who lost his life, and three others who were
absolutely
very injured. Tragic. And there's no question that it's a tragedy. The question is, how do we go forward from here? And is this wise policy?
Do I need to point out every single week? Because every single week there is a new example of why guns have no place in our society.
I know.
And I know I'm going to win this argument eventually because let's wait. Next time there's a week that goes by where something like this doesn't happen, you tell me. Okay?
All right.
And then we'll see if you can convince me to change my mind.
All right.
But I don't think it's going to happen because every week something like this happens. Every week something like this happens somewhere.
That sounds good. We will do that. Well, we're not going to get into the specifics, Kirk, of the John Doe investigation that is still ongoing.
Yeah, it's going all over the place.
This is an evolving story. But I just wanted to point out the real controversy here, again, without getting political, without getting partisan here. The real controversy in this case seems to be is clearly over election law, because what we're talking about here is an allegation by certain prosecutors and a special prosecutor that there was something wrong happening in terms of campaign coordination. And I've done a lot of research on this. You and I practice in criminal defense. However, the issue in this case seems to revolve around election law and whether you can engage in what they call express advocacy or issue advocacy and what violates Wisconsin's
It's really
election
complicated.
Law. It's very complicated. But the gist of it, as far as I can tell, is that express advocacy comes down to an advertisement of some sort where you're saying, vote for Scott
so-and-so,
Walker
so-and-so.
Or whoever the case may be, or vote for Mary Burke, right? And so that would be an example of express advocacy. Issue advocacy,
yeah.
on the other hand, is something where you're saying
such and such company
agrees
with this
type
position,
of issue.
This
position on this issue, but not mentioning a specific candidate.
Save the whales, save the babies, whatever.
Exactly. And the controversy comes down to whether issue advocacy can fall under the law in Wisconsin against campaign coordination, especially without disclosing your donors. So that seems to be the entire controversy here. But what's interesting procedurally about this is that you have this investigation in secret, a John Doe investigation in secret. Now documents have been released. And so some of this is sort of leaking out as to what's going on here. And prosecutors have not filed any sort of formal criminal charges against the governor.
Right.
That's been clear.
And the investigation itself has been
halted
by two different courts. I don't know that means that there isn't anything wrong.
That doesn't mean it's not there. It's on appeal right now.
It's a procedural aspect. And there are other parties' rights that are at risk of being violated here, including those organizations that are engaging in purportedly issue advocacy, but it could be express advocacy.
Well, or versions of issue advocacy that could fall under the campaign coordination. It's very, very complicated.
Yeah. And the idea is that no particular candidate should have an unfair advantage due to deep pockets. I mean, isn't that what it's really all about?
Yeah.
Is that certain parties, certain candidates may be able to appeal to people that have or corporations that have a lot of money that are able to advance that cause and give an unfair advantage because of the nature of the issue. I'm reading a book right now. Another book I'll give to you when I'm done with it.
All right,
I'm not
great.
Done with it yet.
Excellent.
But it's about Teddy Roosevelt and a lot of the very different things that he did when he first became president and after he was elected to his second term. A lot of the back then it was possible for a president to run for a third term because that law didn't change until much later. But he announced that he believed it was not only gentlemanly, but also good for the country to announce that he would not run for a third term. I think it's also because he wanted to go on a year-long tour of Africa. But aside, which he did, actually. A lot of the laws that we had originally that restricted campaign contributions from large corporate entities, or for that matter, payments that could be made to any person in office. A lot of the original laws on the principle, and this is coming from the President of the United States, that big money has no place in politics. And it was, look at how far we've come from that. Hey, we're almost running out of time, but there's a very important story that I need to talk to you about. And did you ever have those little scratch and sniff books when you were a kid?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, did you know that in the, I think it's in the United Kingdom now, they're passing out these scratch and sniff cards to not only police officers, but also you know, people. And it, if you scratch it and you sniff it, it's that distinct odor of marijuana. And it's designed to educate people, just in case you don't know what it smells like.
Interesting.
What it smells like.
And why would normal citizens want to know what it smells like?
In case you're in a pub, or if you were anywhere else, and you detect this odor, you're like, wait a minute! That smells like the thing that the government gave me so that I know what marijuana smells like. Tweet, tweet. And, you know, you blow your whistle because they don't, you know, you can't do anything else in England. You just blow your whistle.
Yeah.
And they, and then the police come running and they arrest the guy because he's smoking marijuana. But here's the thing that I find so ironic about this. How many times have I heard, I know you've probably heard it too,
yeah,
the, a police officer in court testify that marijuana has this distinct odor. Nothing else in the world smells like it. So if it's that distinct and there's nothing else in the world that smells like it, what are these cards that you scratch and sniff made out of? Are they made out of marijuana?
That's a good question.
And so, if they are, then people are possessing marijuana. If they're not, that means that there's other stuff that smells
smell
just like marijuana.
That's a great point.
Oh my gosh.
And the question is, on these scratch and sniff cards, is it fresh marijuana or is it, old?
Is it marijuana? Old? Is it burnt? Or raw?
Which type raw?
I don't know.
I wonder if they have different cards that differentiate between those different types of marijuana.
Dude, we have smoked all of our time.
All right.
It's done.
Well, this has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a great weekend.